I'm Sheila Cast, and this is Midday. The deaths of more than 80,000 blacks, Hispanics, and other minority Americans each year are attributed to health disparities. These are inconsistencies between whites and blacks, not only in overall health status, but specifically in the quality of medical care received by African Americans. Why are African American patients sicker and more likely to die than white patients? Thomas LeVeast, director of the Hopkins Center for Health Disparities Solutions, breaks down the myths behind common explanations for health disparities, such as poverty and lack of access. And Dana Bowen-Mathieu, author and law professor at the University of Colorado Law School, argues that unconscious racial bias by doctors is driving unequal treatment, and that such implicit bias can be changed. It's Midday, after the news. Welcome to Midday, everyone. I'm Sheila Cast. We have a challenging issue before us today, so I'm glad you're with us to take it on. African Americans are three times as likely as whites to develop cardiovascular disease and are twice as likely to die from it. Black men are seven times more likely than white men to receive a diagnosis of HIV and more than twice as likely to die of prostate cancer. Black women have nearly double the obesity rate of white women and are 40% more likely to die from breast cancer. Research by former U.S. Surgeon General Dr. David Satcher estimates that nearly 84,000 deaths could be prevented each year if the United States were to eliminate gaps in mortality between black and white Americans. 84,000 lives. We hear these statistics, but what do we understand about what is causing the health of whites and blacks to be so drastically different? Today, we'll look at some of the reasons often cited, how well they hold up to scrutiny, and we'll look at differences in how minority patients are treated by the health system. We'll also hear about a potential legal remedy to address unequal treatment of minority patients. With me in the studio is Dr. Thomas LeVeast. He's director of the Hopkins Center for Health Disparities Solutions at the Johns Hopkins Bloomberg School of Public Health. He's an expert on social and racial disparities in health and how such disparities impact health at both the individual and community level. Next month, he'll add another line to his resume when he joins the George Washington University Milken Institute School of Public Health as chair of health policy and the Health Policy and Management Department. It's good to see you again. Thanks.
It's good to see you.
Thanks for being here. And also with us is Dana Bowen-Mathieu, author of Just Medicine, A Cure for Racial Inequality in American Healthcare, published just this week by New York University Press. She's a professor of law at the University of Colorado Law School and the Colorado School of Public Health. Welcome.
It's my pleasure.
Dr. LeVeast, how do you describe to people the overall picture of health disparities? Is there a particular statistic you find sort of encapsulates the problem or catches people's attention? Or what is the best foundational understanding for us to have?
Yeah, I like two. I like the David Satcher's number, the excess mortality. I think that helps to illustrate the issue. There's also a report that we worked on a few years ago called The Economic Burden of Health Inequalities, where we calculated the impact of health and health disparities on the U.S. economy, and we estimated that cost to be at $1.24 trillion over 4 years. So it shows that there's not only a health impact, there's not only an impact on individuals, but it's impacting everyone because it impacts the economy. It's a significant drag on the efficiency of the economy.
And you find that is an important thing to tell people, that it's not all about social justice in terms of people's experience, but it's also about the economy?
Sure. So the idea of doing the report in the first place was that, you know, we felt that we had probably gotten as many people under the tent of health disparities based on the social justice argument, but that we needed to go beyond that. And we thought, what if we can make a utilitarian argument? What if we can show that, you know, even if you are not personally affected by it, you are still affected by it because the entire society is affected by it. It hurts us all. It's resources that could be used to solve other pressing problems we have.
Dana Bowen-Mathieu, what is your overall picture? You've written this book now. You've been working on this issue for a long time. How do you find it most useful to give people a foundational understanding of what the disparities are?
I'd like to add to the monetary case that Dr. LeVeast has made and the medical case that Dr. Satcher made a moral case, a case that's legal. In this country, we feel pretty strongly about equality, pretty strongly about justice, pretty strongly about fairness. And this is a legal matter, and I would like to see the law change so that it sets the social norm differently, so that medicine will change, and so that those who are causing these disparities will change.
Can you make a distinction in describing, again, the extent of the problem between the status of people and the action of treatment in healthcare?
Sure. Thank you for the question, because that's exactly what my book is about. It's about not just the terrible statistics, which I think are untenable on so many levels that you open the program with, but it's about the fact that the treatment that causes those statistics is medical in nature, and it can be changed. So unconscious racism, or implicit biases, as we've also called them, actually causes doctors to make less eye contact, give less information, to make treatment decisions that they wouldn't make for white patients, for patients of color. So these are the actual mechanisms, if you will, that cause the disparities that your statistics describe, the status that you describe.
And this, I know this is not a new assertion. I read that the Institute of Medicine in 2003 published an entire book about this. But I confess, and Dr. Lavis, you've been part of my education. I have learned much more about other social determinants of health that are not treatment, that are either stresses on individuals or the context in which people live. Help me put these two things in context. We're going to talk a lot more, Dana Bone-Matthew, about implicit bias and what you think should be done about it. But I don't want to lose track of these other factors. And I want to get some sense from both of you as to what you think carries the most burden of these disparities we're talking about.
Yeah, I think one way to think about it that might be helpful is to think of really two categories. You have health status disparities, which is what you opened the show with. In other words, differences in rates of disease, differences in death rates, differences in life expectancy, things like that. But then you also have health care disparities, which I think is more focused in the healthcare system. So differences in access to care, differences in quality of care received, differences in outcomes that patients have as a result of their experience in the healthcare system. So the social determinants that you're talking about, they play a huge role on the health status disparities.
And just take a second to tell us when you refer to social determinants, what you're talking about.
Well, the social and the physical environment that people live in. So there are certain communities that don't have access to good quality foods, don't have access to good schools, that are more stressful environments to live in because of crime, don't have access to green space, to exercise, don't have good access to full-service supermarkets or restaurants. So the infrastructure necessary to support healthy lifestyles don't exist in certain communities. And that environment, that social environment, has an impact on the health of people living in those communities. So the social determinants would be those factors, the social environment where people live.
And I think, as I sort of look at my own thinking in this area, those social determinants, such a wide net and so interconnected and so many root causes, it begins to seem a little bit like, well, we can try to make some progress, but it's going to be really hard and long to fix this.
Yeah.
Those influences on disparities, on those factors in why blacks' health status is so much lower than whites.
But they're not immutable. So if you think, and this is perfect for a Baltimore audience. So if you imagine yourself standing in the harbor and you walk about a mile and a half to your south, and you're in Federal Hill. You walk about a mile and a half to your north and west, and you're in Upton. The architecture of the buildings are exactly the same. They're row houses. They're the same row houses built during the same era. They have the same challenges in that they are 80 or 90 years old and filled with lead paint. But the difference in life expectancy between people living in Federal Hill versus Upton, the last report that I saw from the city planning office, was about 12 years difference. And we're talking about physically about 3 miles apart. It's the difference in the social context in which people are living in Upton versus Federal Hill.
That is Dr. Thomas Leviste. He is, I'm looking for all of your titles. He is the professor of health policy and director of the Hopkins Center for Health Disparity Solutions at Johns Hopkins Bloomberg School of Public Health here on Midday on WIPR. I'm Sheila Kast. And also with us is Dana Bowen-Matthew, whose new book is Just Medicine, A Cure for Racial Inequality in American Healthcare. If you want to be part of this conversation, if you feel you've had an experience of being treated differently because of your race, or if you have an idea about how it could be ameliorated, how it could get better, you can join this conversation. You can call us. Our local number is 410-662-8780. Our long-distance number, our toll-free number, is 1-866-661-9309, or you can send us an email at midday@wypr.org. We'd love for you to be part of this conversation. Dana Bowen-Matthew, Dr. Leviste just talked about, gave us sort of a quick description of some of the social determinants, but you're focusing on treatment in the system, not sort of what a patient walks in with, but what happens once a patient is in touch with the medical system. And what do you say the problem is?
Let me suggest that there's a real intimate connection between what Dr. Leviste just talked about and the problem I'm trying to solve, the treatment problem. So I would like to argue that if we solve implicit biases in the treatment context, then doctors and providers, clinicians, will be free to help advocate for improvement in the social determinants of health. And in fact, who better than to advocate? Let me give you an example. So a doctor has a patient with asthma, which is something I'm sure Baltimoreans are very familiar with. Children with asthma get albuterol. They get these inhalers. The inhaler will do them absolutely no good if they go home to an apartment that's mold infested, that's rat infested, that has mold and lead paint in it. So the doctor who really wants to treat the whole patient needs to concern him or herself not just with the medical treatment, but also with the social treatment, with becoming an advocate for the patient to have better housing, because that housing is the only thing that's going to actually improve the patient's asthma. So if we are able to get doctors away from their implicit biases so that they see a patient not as a color, not as a category of ethnicity or race, then that doctor will become an advocate and probably one of the strongest advocates for the social determinants of that patient's setting be improved as well.
Okay, I take that point, but I think you are so accustomed to talking about implicit bias that you may have lost track of what an explosive concept it is. So tell us, we're going to take a break in a couple of minutes. You've got a few minutes to introduce us to what you mean by social, by implicit bias.
Sure, sure.
Because certainly a lot of people are thinking, well, my doctor's not biased. She's a pretty terrific person.
So everyone is biased. Even terrific people are biased. Implicit bias describes the kind of unintentional stereotypes that one responds to without even knowing that it's happening in your conduct and your decision making. So over the course of life, everyone in the United States is exposed to music, politics, discussions on TV, experiences, and I'll describe one or two of my own that have really influenced my implicit biases. We're influenced in a way that stores this social knowledge unconsciously. I walk into a room, I see a person of a different race or ethnicity, and unbeknownst to me, these stored experiences are triggered, are activated, are retrieved, and they begin to inform all of my conscious judgments, all of my decision-making, and even my interaction with the person who's across from me. Now, here's the implicit bias explosive point, if you will. I can be an egalitarian. I can be someone who intends to be fair, who intends to be to treat all people equally. Those are my explicit preferences. Those preferences will contradict and actually be subordinate to my implicit biases that I don't even know are taking over. So the explosive concept, if you will, is that very fair, very nice doctors who intend to treat patients equally can't help the fact that they've got all of this stored knowledge with stereotypes that cause them to do the opposite, to discriminate.
Well, tell us more about what the action of this implicit bias. I mean, first of all, we may get back to, and some of our listeners may want to get back to the idea that if, as you say, this is information that we didn't, as you describe it, it's not information we sort of sought to collect. It's just kind of what sticks to us as we go through our lives and we hang on to it. So if you don't have that set of assumptions, you're going to have some other. I mean, we all pick up information as we go through life. So we may want to talk more about what you'd replace that social knowledge with if it's triggering a bias. But before we get further into that, just try to make me understand. I really tried as I read your book. Try to help me understand how you think this works in medical treatment.
Sure.
What happens?
Sure. A number of things happen. I look at a patient, I, the doctor, look at a patient differently because I presume that patient of color is not cooperative, is not able, from a resources standpoint, to adapt themselves to the treatment of choice. And unconsciously, I give them an inferior treatment than that which I would give a white patient based on my presumptions about them. That's one way. Another way it might manifest is that I walk in, I'm the doctor, and I see a patient of color. And I make less eye contact, I give fewer facts, I give less than the optimal options for, say, transplant care.
Why am I doing that?
I'm doing that because unconsciously I think that patient either can't intellectually handle the complexity of the regimen, or that patient doesn't have the support system. Why? My stored knowledge tells me that there's an achievement gap. People are less educated when they're from communities of colors. So I make the assumption that although that data might be true generally, it's also true about the patient in front of me. I don't know it, but I assume it. And that assumption makes me make my medical treatment decisions, hold my clinical encounter differently, even interpret statistical data differently, unbeknownst to me, because again, it's unintentional.
As I said, we need to take a break. I am dying to hear what Dr. Leviste thinks of this. And I, listeners, I'm dying to think of what you think of this also. Our local number for you to call, 410-662-8780, or you can send us an email at midday@wypr.org. We also have a toll-free number, which is 1-866-661-9309. We're going to take a break and continue our conversation with Dr. Thomas Leviste, director of the Hopkins Center for Health Disparities Solutions at the Johns Hopkins Bloomberg School of Public Health, and Dana Bowen-Matthew, law professor and author of Just Medicine, A Cure for Racial Inequality in American Healthcare. I'm Sheila Cast. We'll be back in just a bit. Welcome back to Midday. Sheila Cast here. Why are African Americans living sicker and dying younger than all other ethnic groups? Why are their interactions with the healthcare system, receiving diagnoses, treatments, and preventive care, why are they less effective? I'm speaking with two experts on health disparity, Dr. Thomas Leviste, director of the Hopkins Center for Health Disparities Solutions at the Johns Hopkins Bloomberg School of Public Health, and Dana Bowen-Matthew, law professor at the University of Colorado and author of Just Medicine, A Cure for Racial Inequality in American Healthcare, published by New York University Press. And what about you? Do you think doctors treat patients of different races equally? Have racial biases affected your relationship with your doctor or with another healthcare provider? If you have a question or comment, you can be part of this conversation. Our local number is 410-662-8780. Our email address is midday@wypr.org. As I said before the break, Dr. Leviste, the description that we are hearing from Dana Bowen-Mathieu about implicit bias being part of the way a doctor interacts with patients, what's your view of that?
Yeah, there certainly is a growing literature that demonstrates that implicit bias is having an impact on disparities in healthcare quality. There have been a number of studies, including some studies done here at Hopkins, that demonstrate that this is the case. You know, in work that I've done, you know, I've did a study of three hospitals once where we were given unfettered access to the hospital and to their records and to any employee. And what we found there was that, and having spent a lot of time in these hospitals, I am absolutely convinced that the medical staff there were people that were truly caring and truly wanted to provide good quality care. I'm absolutely convinced of it. But when we looked at the actual statistics, we found that African American patients were about half as likely to be referred for certain cardiac procedures when they were medically indicated and when they had the same insurance and ability to pay. So when you take out insurance and ability to pay and access to the hospitals, we still found a 2-to-1 referral rate difference.
So in other words, this was not a question where a well-meaning doctor thought this patient won't be able to afford this expensive treatment.
No.
I'll find some alternate treatment that will help them. This is not the case.
I don't think that's what's happening. I do not for one second believe, certainly I can say in the case of that study and those doctors, that they are not saying, oh, this is a black patient, I'm not going to give them good quality care. Here's a white patient, I'm going to give them good quality care. I do not believe it happens that way at all. I know far too many, personally know far too many clinicians to believe that's the case in most cases. I think it is something that happens in a subconscious way. You feel closer to people. You have relationships with people. You feel that you could potentially develop a relationship with a person based on certain characteristics, if they are more similar to you. I think it's the way the human brain operates. We seek people that are more like us, who have similar values, who act the same way, who come from similar cultural backgrounds, and we're able to empathize more, we feel closer to them, and I think we're more likely to provide better care because we have that greater sense of community with them.
Well, Dana Bowen-Mathieu, certainly you stress, oh my gosh, so many times, that you are not talking about intentional harm, that you are not talking about a situation of a bigoted healthcare provider not wanting to provide as good care. But you make the point that unconscious rather than intentional racism, you say, quote, unconscious rather than intentional racism has become the new normal. Explain that a little bit.
It's not only in medical care that's the case. And I want to echo what Dr. LaVista said. I am not only married to a doctor, but I know too many clinicians to know that they would be horrified to think that they were, quote unquote, racists from an intentional standpoint. But nonetheless, the new normal is that my unintentional biases are explained away. We see it in the criminal justice system with shooter bias. We see it in the jury system.
Shooter bias, you mean police officers?
Police officers more quickly inclined to shoot a person of color than a white person in experiments and in simulations. We see it in jury systems, jury selection processes, jury decision making. We see it in the employment context. So the literature about implicit bias is extensive, not only in the medical field, but elsewhere. And because it is so difficult to identify when it's happening, because it happens to the best intentioned people, people who intend to be egalitarian, I say it's the new normal because we are ignoring it. I say it's the new normal because we're not accounting for the contribution, which I suggest is significant, to the disparities in status of health in the healthcare system.
Significant. I mean, would you say it is the primary reason that there are such striking disparities in life expectancy and health status?
So that's a quantitative question, and I don't have the data to support that it is the primary causal factor. I do have a mountain of data that shows that through all of these different mechanisms that I've described, communication, perceptions, data collection, and so forth, that there is an association between implicit bias and bad treatment. I think one of the best studies came from Alexander Green, when he not only measured quantifiably the level of implicit biases that doctors had, so you can do that with an implicit association test, but he correlated it with their decision-making with regard to coronary artery disease patients. So the disease treatment of choice was more frequently given to whites over blacks when the implicit bias level of the physician was high. And the reverse was true. So a correlation between implicit bias and poor treatment is clear in the data, and therefore I think a large contribution. The data doesn't yet tell us how large.
And I'm speaking here. This is midday on WIPR. I'm Sheila Cast. I'm speaking with two experts who study and have studied health disparities in a very sort of organized, I would say, academic way. And I don't mean that pejoratively. Dr. Thomas Leviste of the Hopkins Center. I should not freelance the title of your. The Hopkins Center for Health Disparity Solutions at the Bloomberg School of Public Health at Johns Hopkins, and Dana Bowen Matthew, law professor, author of Just Medicine. But you're talking about measuring implicit bias as if everybody knows that that can be done. And it seems to me it would be really hard to measure. Is there a simple way of describing to a layman like me how you can be so sure you've measured implicit bias?
There are a lot of tests, but the most frequently used in the literature that I've cited in the book is called the implicit association test. I'll call it the IAT for short. The IAT has been validated. It's been used for over 400,000 participants, and this is how it works, essentially. A person goes to a computer program, and they're shown a combination of photographs and words. And the photographs are of phenotypically black or Latino people in the tests that I've used in my data collection, and words that are good, bad, nice, pretty, and you're to pair these words quickly. Now, the premise of the test is that the more quickly you pair the word with the picture, the more instinctive or implicit your association is. So if you pair a good word with a phenotypically black person easily, you are not likely to be biased against blacks. If you have difficulty pairing a good word with a black picture easily, you have a higher score. The test actually measures time. So you come up with a number that says how fast were you able to make the association of good words and bad words with phenotypically black and white pictures. Along that principle, we're able to use the IAT to both measure implicit biases along with other tests. There are other types of tests also, and then correlate that with decision making.
That is Dana Bowen Matthew here on Midday on WIPR. I'm Sheila Cass. She is the author of Just Medicine, A Cure for Racial Inequality. Also with us is Thomas Leviste of the Johns Hopkins Bloomberg School of Public Health, who directs the Hopkins Center for Health Disparities Solutions. And I want to talk about solutions in just a minute, but I've been inviting our listeners to join the conversation, and some have, more can. If you'd like to call us at 410-662-8780 or send us an email at midday@wypr.org. Jim is calling us from Mount Airy. Welcome to Midday, Jim.
Oh, well, thank you. Thank you for allowing me to put my two cents in this. This is fascinating and interesting to me. I grew up in the Deep South. I grew up in Alabama, and I moved to Maryland by way of the Army, and I do work in the medical profession. I won't go into that, but I was amazed by people that I met from all across the country that would say, I'm not prejudiced. I like people of color. And I, growing up in the Deep South and seeing blatant prejudice, I knew these people are just in denial. I mean, if they would not admit to themselves that they were prejudiced, they just didn't have a good grasp of reality.
Jim, I'm not sure I'm following. You're saying that the people you knew in the Deep South were in denial, or you're saying the people you're encountering here?
No, after I came to Maryland and while I was in the Army, the people from all across the country, I felt like the people in the Deep South had a much better understanding that you like people that are like you, and white people like white people. I mean, and the black people prefer black people. It's just built in. And people that deny that and think that they are just so open and accepting of everybody else, and once you realize that you do have bias and prejudice, you can work from there. But denying that it's there, it is a big mistake. And I want to commend the doctors for putting this into such a good format, because this is something that people need to realize. And once they realize it, they can work with it. But as long as they're going to deny it, they're just out of touch.
Jim, I appreciate your calling. Ms. Matthews, you were nodding vigorously while Jim was talking.
Yeah, I want to just pick up on something that Jim has said, and that is that we can work from there if we have recognition. Let me just go back to that Alexander Green study for a second. There were a number of doctors, 67, if I remember correctly, of the 700 that were in the study, who, unlike the rest of the participants, were told that this was a study about their racial bias. Do you know that the pattern I described for them was different? In other words, just having the knowledge that they had implicit biases changed their prescribing decision making. Unlike the doctors who had no idea, who were living in the dark, to use Jim's word, were in denial, who made treatment decisions that correlated with their racial biases, these doctors actually were able to correct for that. So there's something that we can do about it, and that's why I think Jim's point is well taken.
And Dr. LaVista, on that point, let me turn to you. I'm assuming a link here that I have no factual basis for assuming, but I'm assuming that this pattern that Dana Matthew just described is somebody, instead of acting on a health provider, instead of acting on sort of a gut sense, reverted to prescribe, this is how this condition, this is how the books say to treat this condition. Is that an answer or a partial answer to what you say you see in the treatment interaction, that a doctor, instead of kind of freelancing a treatment plan for this patient, should go by the book?
I do think that's a big part of the solution. If you look at experience-based medical practice versus evidence-based, often providers are practicing on the basis of their experience. So you hear things like, in my experience, patients with this set of characteristics do better on this medication versus that medication, rather than relying on the evidence base, the actual studies and guidelines that have been established based on that evidence base, and saying the guidelines say that a patient with this condition or with this set of medical characteristics should get this treatment. That's where you get the opportunity for judgment, more judgment to come into play, and that's where the biases can have a bigger impact. So where you don't find disparities, at least not in a big way, is in the active duty military, where you do find it in the VA, but in the active duty military, you don't find disparities in patient outcomes and quality of care, because they tend to practice in a very regimented way, where they're following sort of a cookbook approach. Patient has this, this is the medication we give them. If that doesn't work, we then do this. If that doesn't work, we then do this. And they're following that set of algorithms. When outside of that, outside of a context like that, the physicians are practicing on the basis of their experience, their judgment, and sometimes their judgment may be off, because what you don't see when you are in a medical or clinic, you see the numerator, but you don't know the denominator. So in other words, you see people that come in, and you see, today I had 7 black female patients, and all 7 of those patients had this. Therefore, all black females have this. And that's the kind of thinking that our brain does naturally.
We all do this.
But that's wrong.
I'm trying to wrap my head around this, and listeners, I imagine you are too. We're going to take a break. Maybe you can use that to wrap your head around this. We're talking with Thomas LaVista, director of the Hopkins Center for Health Disparity Solutions at the Bloomberg School of Public Health, and Dana Bowen-Matthew, law professor at the University of Colorado, author of Just Medicine, A Cure for Racial Inequality in American Healthcare. You can be part of the conversation. We're going to talk about solutions when we come back. I see Eric is on the line with a question about a solution. I hope he can stay with us. And I know that Dana Bowen-Matthew has a different approach. Call us at 410-662-8780. Send us an email at midday@wypr.org. And whatever you do, stick with us through this break. I'm Sheila Cast. We'll be right back. Welcome back to Midday, everyone. I'm Sheila Cast. We're talking about disparities in American healthcare and the role that implicit bias by healthcare providers plays in them. We're talking with Thomas Leviste, director of the Hopkins Center for Health Disparity Solutions at the Johns Hopkins Bloomberg School of Public Health, and with Dana Bowen-Mathieu, law professor at the University of Colorado, author of Just Medicine, A Cure for Racial Inequality in American Healthcare. And we're talking with our listeners who have called us at 410-662-8780 or send us an email at midday@wypr.org. You can do that too. Eric has been holding. Eric, welcome to Midday.
Oh, thank you, Sheila. A question and a hypothesis. Do the data show that the disparities, do they show that the disparities are as dramatic among the elderly as among the population that, as a whole, or among the younger?
Okay, that's Eric's question. I was expecting, Eric, that you were going to ask why addressing poverty wouldn't be the solution. So maybe we can deal with both of those. Do either one of you want to address Eric's question about the elderly?
Well, I think clearly the evidence shows that that the disparities exist at all points in the lifespan, including among elderly.
Okay. And what about Eric's original question that he gave to our producer? Why would not addressing poverty address this problem?
Yeah, I'm really glad that this issue came up, because it's one of the myths that I spent a lot of time trying to debunk, that racial disparities are really about socioeconomic status or poverty, which it is not. We have a new study that hasn't yet been released, but I'll sort of preview it here. And where we looked at people with incomes over $175,000 and to see whether there are racial disparities among people in a very high income category. And what we found is that the disparities in some cases are actually wider than they are among people with lower incomes. So
this is can you tell us any more about this?
Racial
it's really hard to absorb that.
Yeah, I know.
I can't wait for your study.
The racial disparities exist at all levels, and in fact, they get worse as income increases, because at the lowest income levels, you have people who are all suffering from living in environments that are not conducive to healthy lifestyles. So the whites are living in those environments, and they're doing poorly as well. When you get into the higher income levels, you have people that have more variety in where they're living and what their lifestyles are. But what you have among African Americans at that income level are people that are often living in very isolated environments, both physically isolated but also socially isolated environments, that there's a lot of stress that goes along with being the one African American in the corporate boardroom and the one African American at the meeting all of the time. And I think that's a lot of what produces that disparity and why it actually widens. So we didn't look at health care or what happens within the health care
system. Oh, this is their health status.
This is looking at their health
status.
So you think
your hypothesis is the stress.
You have additional sources of stress.
Okay. We got an email from Dan asking, do black clinicians demonstrate the same level of bias toward black patients?
So here's the dirty little secret, Diane. The fact that...
No, I'm Sheila.
No, Diane is the questioner, right?
Dan,
forgive me.
That's okay.
So Dan, great question. Yes, is the answer. Anyone who takes an implicit association test is basically testing their associations based on what they've learned socially from living in the United States. Black, white, Asian, Latino, anybody who lives in this country has the same social knowledge as input. This was confirmed in the interviews that I took. I was shocked at the number of African-American women with fibroids who said that they had African-American doctors just not believe them or tell them, essentially, in their terms and perceptions, tough it out. Right. You are a black woman, therefore able to take this pain more than others can take
goodness.
It. Right. Oh, my goodness is right.
So strong angels.
We are all susceptible. Now, what you see in the IAT results is that there's a range. There are by far and away a majority of Americans, black, white, Latino, any color that we come in, who have an anti-black pro-white bias. There are some of us, 2% of us, who end up with an anti-white pro-black bias. And it doesn't matter what color you are. It matters what experiences you have had.
Well, let me pull Monica. Monica also sent us an email, and her question was, what about unconscious bias from patients? Are they less likely to trust a doctor of a different race? Dr. Lubis, you've looked at that, I think.
Yeah. Well, what we found is a little different, because we were looking at something more explicit. We found that patients were more likely to express trust and express satisfaction with physicians that were of the same racial and ethnic background that they were. Now, that's their explicit expression. Now, what I don't know is implicitly how that would have been, those questions would have been answered.
But I hypothesize, based on some qualitative data, that the answer to that is yes as well. That by implicit biases, patients make determinations about how well they will follow up, whether they will adhere, whether they're going to stay with a physician or not. I had one African-American patient say to me, I knew he was prejudiced, and so I didn't go back. Well, what does that mean for continuity of care? What does that mean for whether they actually have adherence that will allow them to get better? That, I suggest, has a health outcome impact also. The patient's bias not only has to do with their satisfaction, but what they do about their follow-up care after they leave that unsatisfying encounter.
And what we did find in that study was that patients were more likely to utilize health services when they thought they needed, and less likely to not use when they felt that they had a need. They were less likely to do that if their primary physician was the same racial ethnic group as they were.
So Dr. LaVista a few minutes ago told us that one part of the solution might be for doctors to go by the book and try to, instead of acting on assumptions, to follow evidence. Evidence-based care is
follow
a big part of
yes.
the Affordable Care Act, for example. But you have a different proposed solution, Ms. Matthews. Tell us about that.
I think that discrimination should be illegal in the United States in the way that it's practiced today. That is to say that when we had Title VI of the Civil Rights Act passed, most of the discrimination that we were dealing with was explicit, express prejudice and bigotry. It has morphed in this country to a new norm of implicit, unconscious bias. And I suggest that the law should also reflect that change in behavior. So I would like to see three changes in Title VI so that it would create
Title VI of the Civil Rights Act of 1964.
That's right. Title VI of the Civil Rights of 1964 says essentially that no person shall be discriminated against, denied the benefits of a federally financed program on the basis of their race, color, or national origin. That statute creates a social norm, and I suggest that the social norm creating work of law should be updated. Now, it's not to say that we will litigate our way out of implicit bias.
We will
not litigate our way out of implicit bias.
And actually, hold that thought. There's a premise I should have asked first. When you talk about implicit bias, I'm reading your book and I'm thinking, we can't change that. I mean, we're not aware of it. How can we possibly change it? You say that's not true.
That's absolutely not true. We have 25 years of literature that tells us implicit biases are, and I'll use the sociological term, malleable. Malleable simply means we can influence it. We can change it from the outside and from the inside.
How?
At least two ways have been shown to be really effective. One is by creating counter-stereotypes. It picks up on Dr. Levist's...
Counter-stereotypes.
Exactly. It picks up on Dr. Levist's data that says that when the physician-patient dyad has similarly raced people so that there are black physicians and black patients, the patient is likely to have more satisfaction, likely to have higher compliance, likely to have better health outcomes. What do I mean by that? Counter-stereotypes just means we need more diversity in the medical profession. People at very high decision-making ranks, the workforce has to be more diversified. This will increase the counter-stereotypes, to use the term from the implicit bias literature, but it will also increase the patient satisfaction and better health outcomes. That's one way. Another way that's been shown in the literature to be very effective is stereotype negation training. This is to be distinguished dramatically from cultural competence. Cultural competence is not stereotype negation. Think of it this way. Stereotypes develop over a lifetime. If you understand what I've said about implicit bias, you need extended training, interaction, conversations, journaling, experiences, and the hard conversations to negate those habits that have formed over a lifetime. That kind of training also works to reduce biases.
And so you're saying that the law, the civil rights law, should be changed to require that kind of training?
To set the standard at a negligence level so that anyone who reasonably attempts to use the evidence that will train, that will diversify, that will address implicit biases has a defense against a discrimination action. Anyone who doesn't is liable.
Dr. Leist, what do you think of this? The idea of using the Civil Rights Act, changing, revising the Civil Rights Act to make it a tool against implicit bias.
I need to understand it a little better, to be honest. I don't fully understand.
I will share my copy of Dana Bowen Matthews' book with you.
I have seen that.
You have the book,
you know,
okay.
I do have that. You know, I think one of the things I should say I do have the book, but I haven't finished reading that section of the book, so I'm only hearing it for the first time now. But what I can say about that is that one of the things that I'd be concerned about, and this comes from a conversation I had with the Office of Civil Rights back in the 1990s, we were talking about doing research in hospitals, looking at bias, and one of the concerns that we had was the hospitals that's allowing us to come in and do this work could potentially be putting themselves at risk. And we got a ruling from the Office of Civil Rights saying that we absolutely would not want to do that because the concern would be that we would create a disincentive for people to look at what's happening within their health systems. So I would just need to understand the proposal a little bit better, but that would be something that would be a concern for
me.
And
we have just a minute left, so I'll give you the closing thought on this.
It's the opposite of a disincentive. It is an incentive to create the kinds of solutions that will be considered reasonable so that the law won't matter. What law does, the expressive role of law, is it says, here's the social norm. Think of the civil rights movement. Here's the social norm. Once it's established, then the hospitals will have the incentive to live up to it and to exceed it. So the law will be the floor, and hospitals will be protected by the floor, and they'll go further to address implicit biases because of the change in law.
What is your sense, as I said, we have just a half minute here, what is your sense of how people are reacting to your book? I mean, is this going to be a big topic? Is it already a big topic among doctors?
I think it's a big topic, but it needs to be a bigger topic. What I'd like to see is that my book incentivizes action, that my book incentivizes patients and providers and clinicians and policymakers to all come together and realize that this is untenable. We have to change our approaches, and we have to do something about health injustice.
I'm grateful to both of you for giving us so much to think about. I'm sorry to our callers whom we haven't gotten to. It is an important topic. We've been here with Dana Bowen Matthew, law professor at the University of Colorado and author of Just Medicine, A Cure for Racial Inequality in American Healthcare, published by New York University Press, and with Dr. Thomas Leveast, director of the Hopkins Center for Health Disparities Solutions at the Johns Hopkins Bloomberg School of Public Health, and soon to add another job at the George Washington University's Milken Institute School of Public Health as chair of the Health Policy and Management Department. Thanks to both of you, and thanks to Eddie's of Roland Park for providing lunch for our guests. Eddie's is a full-service market with locations on North Charles Street and on Roland Avenue in Roland Park. Their deli features sandwiches and salads with specials each day, all listed on their website, eddiesofrolandpark.com. Tune in tomorrow for Midday's Friday News Roundup, and stay tuned now for Here and Now. I'm Sheila Cast. I hope you have a great afternoon.
Midday is produced by Maureen Harvey and Connor Graham. The show is engineered by Luke Spicknall. Music produced by Jeff Truman and High Gravity Sounds. Midday podcasts and live streaming are available at WYPR.org or on demand using the WYPR app. This is WYPR, your NPR news station.